This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Actually holding up Britney Spears as a model.
The 2000 VMAs where she performed Oops, I Did It Again in the sparkly bodysuit.
Yeah? Did you say sparkly bodysuit?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Hawaiian-shirted rhinoceros of education policy, Dara Z. Handler.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here a little bit.
What's that reference to, Dara? Of course.
It is our What Parents Want survey out a couple days ago. And we surveyed parents. We figured out what they wanted from their schools and educational goals for their students. And one of our favorite parts was coming up with characters for the different niche markets that we uncovered. And my favorite is a sunglass-wearing Hawaiian-shirted rhinoceros.
Yes.
What was your favorite?
Well, it's hard to beat that one, I would say. I actually, in that same picture, this was for our multiculturalists, parents who want their children to learn, to work together, get along with people from diverse cultures. I liked the dog in the beret in that one, and the dog in the karate outfit. That the whole thing, the whole multiculturalist thing really worked for me.
I do like the monkey playing sitar. The sitar playing monkey.
Yes, yes.
Also.
Yes. I agree. That one was actually inspired by people I know in Tacoma Park. They're all pieced out in their tie-dye shirts and everything. And
probably some yes. people I went to college with.
That's right. And I think somebody did have a monkey that played sitar in Tacoma Park. I think that happens there. That does happen. We'll talk more about that study in a little bit, Dara. I just want everybody to notice that I did not call you the Miley Cyrus of education policy, because that would be offensive. But, you know, what do you think about this whole thing here, Dara? For me, from a dad's perspective, I'm like, thank goodness I did not have girls. I got two boys. This is a problem, right? All these girls look up to Hannah Montana, and then she goes off to this nationally televised award show, scantily clad and doing all kinds of crazy things on stage.
Look, as much as people are talking about this, they're talking about shouldn't we be blaming Robin Thicke for his participation as well. All I want to say about that is Miley is no Britney, and I will leave it at that.
So if you're going to do the whole, I'm now an adult, and I'm going to, shed my girlish ways, there's a good way to do it in a bad way. Actually holding up Britney Spears as a model.
The 2000 VMAs where she performed Oops, I Did It Again in the sparkly bodysuit.
Yeah.
It's epic, and it's way better. Miley should take notes on it.
Did you say sparkly bodysuit? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, it's a sparkly, flesh-toned bodysuit, and you could see the top of her thong underwear. I know you've seen it. Everybody has seen it.
It does ring some bells. But if I go look for this online, will that make me a dirty old man or not?
No, I'll send you a link.
All right, thank you. Okay, I was going to say topic number two. I feel like we're already debating. No, we haven't even started. Pardon the Gadfly. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Michelle, get us started.
Arnie Duncan wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post calling for reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. But does the administration even want reauthorization? Mike, what's going on inside the Beltway?
It's not even worth talking about, Michelle. We should rather talk about Britney Spears' bodysuit, okay? This was the lamest op-ed perhaps ever written before, okay? This op-ed said, we should have a new No Child Left Behind Act. And here's the guy who says, oh, we need Congress to like take this seriously or work on this. Hello, we have a House bill that I think is quite strong. We have a Senate bill that he likes better. Fine, Arne Duncan, get people together, negotiate. Tell Senator Harkin to get his bill across the finish line and let's negotiate. He doesn't want a bill. Arne Duncan does not want this law reauthorized. He is more than happy to just call the tune with his own waiver thing.
I'm sorry, was that Arne Duncan speaking in Britney Spears' voice?
I don't know what that was. I'm not going to do an Arne Duncan impersonation, all right? Because
I think yours was fine.
Yes, people made fun of him for his lisp and all of that, and I don't think that's appropriate. So,
all right, but look, what happens if there is no reauthorization. Is that really that bad for him?
No, that's the point. It's not bad for him because he's happy to be calling the shots right now. He's got all the levers with his waiver policy. If he were to actually negotiate with Republicans to get a bill that could pass both houses of Congress, which I think is doable, he would have to give in on a lot of things. He would actually end up with a lot less authority because they would want to give the states more authority. So he doesn't want to do that.
What are the chances, perhaps, that No Child Left Behind does not get reauthorized? We stay the course as far as the law goes, but then when it comes time to appropriate money, that's where the modifications actually come in.
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's a great question, Jared. They could do more than of that. I mean, there certainly have been times when they've created new programs and that sort of thing. Been plenty of policy making through the appropriations process. I'm surprised we don't see more of that. Okay, next question. Would you want to see Arne Duncan in a flesh-colored, sparkly bodysuit?
I'm not going to answer that. Michelle, what's next?
Topic number two.
This week, Fordham...
You see, if Rick were here, Rick would say, I mean, Arnie's he's a good-looking guy. Heck yeah, I'd want to see that. But that's not
she did not say no.
And that's the difference.
Okay, topic number two.
This week, Fordham released our What Parents Want report, which shows parents want a solid core curriculum in math and reading and schools to specialize. Does this mean that Common Core and school choice can coexist?
Dara?
Absolutely. I think that the image that kept coming to mind is that we pay a lot of attention to bells and whistles when it comes to offering schools. This school has a new high-powered microscope, and this one has a brand new theater or orchestra or whatever. So we pay a lot of attention to bells and whistles, but really what we should be worried about is the train running? And parents want the train to be running, and then you can worry about the bells and whistles on it. And so I don't think that there's any reason why Common Core and school choice can't coexist, because Common Core speaks to a strong core curriculum, and that's by far and away what parents wanted more than anything else. Mm-hmm. You have that in place, and then you can have one school that has an outstanding drama and performing arts program. You have one school that has an incredible STEM program mm-hmm. with an electron microscope. You have one school that focuses on nature and environmental right. issues, but you have to have the core.
And this is not like, well, you know, 59% of parents say a core curriculum is what they want. This is having 2,000 parents go through a list of different things schools could offer and rank them. And time and again and again and again, parents were putting things like a core curriculum in reading and math and critical thinking skills towards the top of their list, right? And this surprised me, I'll be honest. Okay, I had this debate with Bill Jackson at greatschools.net a few years ago. We were doing this study, and he predicted that this is what we were going to find. He was going to say, look, 90% of parents, they just want quality. They don't want any special thing. They just want a quality school. And yes, on the edges, the 10% on the fringes may want something very specialized. And in effect, he's right that, you know, at least when it comes to parents' must-haves, they are mostly the same. And once those are satisfied, then you do find these parents that would like something special on top of that. And that argues for some sense of commonality and some sense of school choice.
I think what is especially interesting here, as it speaks to school choice, is that we didn't ask parents what they wanted and let them choose everything. Mm-hmm. We asked them to prioritize. So they had to, in essence, rank a list of these school characteristics, and they couldn't put everything at the top of their list. Mm-hmm. So these parents that we found who prioritized instruction in arts and music, who prioritized vocational and career and technical education classes, mm-hmm. they didn't just want those things, but those things were actually a higher priority to them. They had to sacrifice other things that the majority of parents wanted, which really does speak to the need to having schools that serve those demands as well.
It's kind of interesting, some of the things that ended up at the bottom of the list. Fluency in a foreign language, not so important to parents compared to other things. Appreciation for nature. I put that one on the list. This was my Waldorf-inspired item. Sorry, environmentalists, not important to parents at all.
When they're forced to choose.
When they're forced to choose. At least, again, maybe they can get that at home. Michelle, topic number three.
The Onion satirized Teach for America and Kids Who Just Want a Real Teacher. Does the Onion staff need a copy of NCTQ's teacher prep report, or do they have a point?
I think this one was pretty funny. I mean, this... you know, this article is basically saying these poor kids, can I just get a teacher who's actually been trained and has, you know, wasn't an English major 3 months ago and, you know, couldn't get a good job and is trying to burnish their reputation for law school. It's pretty funny. I like that. I mean, what do you think about this Teach for America debate, Dara? In places that are laying off teachers, is there any argument for Teach for America?
I think there's always an argument for a system that provides high quality teachers. And the point of the NCTQ report is that 1 or 2 years of a teacher prep program, of a low quality teacher prep program, is worse, or if not, you know, the same as 5 months of a rigorous summer training institute. We also have to keep in mind
5 months, sir.
5 weeks.
Thank
sorry.
You. Do the math
weeks.
On that one.
Five weeks. And I think that we also have to recognize that Teach for America deliberately recruits people who already have a lot of the, the necessary personality traits and characteristics to become high quality teachers. So I think, you know, we do need to be focused on teacher prep and alternative pathways to becoming a teacher. And all of those pathways need to be high quality.
So I have two recommendations. One is I think that Teach for America should focus much more heavily on preschool, because this is an area where we do not have many college educated people going in to serve as teachers. And for low income kids, that would probably help a lot. However, that would mean that these preschool teachers would have to accept lower salaries, right? And we'll see. Are you willing to, you know, do the Teach for America thing, but on a salary of $20,000 instead of $30,000 or $35,000 or $40,000? I think that'd be interesting. Second thing is I think that the brilliance of Teach for America is that they have made teaching prestigious, and they have made it prestigious because it's selective. And I wonder, why can't we have some teaching core, you can call it something else, I don't know, we can come up with a name, that would be a prestigious teaching core that was hard to get into, but that involved training at ed schools around the country. Some of the best ed schools in the country could band together and try to put together a core of five. They're going to say, every year we're going to produce 5,000 teachers coming out of these programs. They're going to be selective, they're going to be rigorous, we're going to brand it, people are going to come to know it. But instead of having the you know, 5 week training, they're going to have more traditional training, and the teachers are going to commit to staying in the classroom for a longer amount of time. To saying this is meant for career teachers, but it's selective, and it's prestigious. Why not?
I think it's a good idea, but the people that you're going to have to convince and at least inform are the school and district level people who are actually doing the hiring, because at this point, and I was told this when I got my credential, that when you graduate from law school, it makes a difference where you went. Did you go to Harvard or did you go to Schmarvard or whatever, you know, the lower quality down the list.
Yeah.
Thanks. But with a teaching credential, as long as you become certified by the state, it doesn't matter where you went to school. That you are, the credential is your credential, regardless of whether you went to...
It doesn't matter to whom, to the HR people, to the principal
who do the hiring? To the HR people, to the principal who do the hiring, especially because sometimes principals don't do their own hiring, depending on what the district rules are for staffing. And so it's especially, you know, the No Child Left Behind requirement that you are a certified teacher.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter the quality of your teacher preparation program. So what we would have to do to encourage, you know, now people look and they say, oh, TFA, that means something. Mm-hmm. But that's the only program that people are really are aware of. So I like your idea, but we would just need to make people aware that this credential actually means something above and beyond checking the box, yes, I'm certified.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Dara earlier held up Britney Spears as a role model. Would you agree with that assessment?
Ooh, I think Britney's turned around. I think she's had some tough things happen to her in her life, but she seems to be on the rebound.
I think she's relatable, too. She had that whole head shaving, umbrella smashing incident, and now she's relatively normal. She has two kids. She's a stay-at-home
mom. Okay, so Miley's at the beginning of this journey, Dara.
That's why I said Britney is a good role model for her, maybe not for everybody else.
Are you upset about the Miley thing?
Ooh, I am upset. I haven't seen it, but wow, it just sounds like it was pretty tawdry.
I mean, you teach Sunday school. Are you worried about the kids there?
Heck yeah, man.
You know,
with a bunch of that stuff. I mean, you know, that's not how we want to be holding up. And gosh, who do kids have to look up to anymore?
But you know what? Britney Spears.
How old are we? People have been saying this since Elvis, right? He was shaking his hips in those suggestive ways. Same thing, right?
And he now had pants on.
Well, he had pants on. All right. That's true. He turned out to be not such the great role model in the end.
No, he did not.
All right. Okay, what you got for us?
Anyway, I've got a new study out in Science Magazine. Kudos to Dan Willingham for calling it to our attention on his blog, by the way. It's called Can Rating Pre-K Programs Predict Children's Learning? So many states vary various inputs of their pre-K programs through this thing called the QRIS, Quality Rating and Improvement System. Basically a long word for a requirement that they have to do to get state and federal funding. So the QRIS measures many different things like staff qualifications, classroom environment, parent-school interactions, child-to-staff ratios, the quality of the teacher-child interaction, and so on. So analysts estimate the relationship between the QRIS ratings and children's learning using data from roughly 2,500 kids in over 670 public pre-K programs across the U.S. They basically want to know where the QRIS identifies high-quality preschools. Okay, mm-hmm. Key finding. Not if you use the measure in the aggregate. So when they rolled it all up, it didn't do a good job identifying high and low quality programs. But if they disentangled it and disaggregated the components, the quality of teacher-child interactions consistently predicted a child's learning in math, pre-reading, language, and social skills. So this is when a real person, living, breathing human being, goes in and fills out this class instrument that Bob Pianta came up with years ago, and it measures things like you know, what type of feedback does the teacher give the child? Does the teacher have control over the classroom, behavior management, that kind of thing. So they close by saying that evaluating pre-K, quality pre-K programs is possible, but maybe we don't need to be measuring all these inputs. Why don't we just measure the ones that matter, like how a child and a teacher interact?
Interesting. And this is so important because obviously there's a big push for pre-K right now, and we certainly support, you know, pre-K for disadvantaged kids. Everybody wants it to be high quality, but what does that mean? And you see the pre-K debate being in some cases where the K-12 debate has been, I don't know, 10 years ago, people looking at teacher qualifications, we need more of these teachers to be college educated or to get these advanced degrees in child development or whatever, or we need smaller class sizes. I mean, granted, we're talking about little kids, so you know, we can't have huge class sizes. And you might, you know, have a hypothesis that if you had people who had gone to college, maybe the child-adult interaction would be better, but not necessarily.
Right, not necessarily.
And so things like those ratios and the teacher qualifications just actually didn't matter.
At least when it was rolled up, you know, into this measure. And I don't think they disaggregate every single component because they didn't have a valid measure to do so. But at least on this measure, it proved to be really informative.
Yeah. I mean, so what do we, do we then say, look, we don't need to worry about getting all pre-K teachers to a bachelor's degree or shrinking those ratios?
Well, how did they define quality of student-teacher interaction? Is it the number of minutes? Is it the level of vocabulary that the adult is using with the child? Is it, I think it really depends on what you actually take, how you're measuring that.
So it was like seven, you know how these studies go. It was seven different measures with all these sub-indicators. But the ones that I most remembered were basically the behavioral management skills, which is huge, and the quality of the feedback you give the child. So I'm assuming you don't just say yes or no. You know, you ask them to explain their answer. Why do you think that? Or what do you base your thought on? You know, just good questioning techniques with kids that good teachers do and some don't. I mean, we know from some of the literature, Teach Like a Champion and some of these other books that try to break down what quality teaching looked like, that the questioning techniques really matter.
Yeah.
That's one of the things this instrument was picking up on.
Can't you just replace quality teaching in this case with quality parenting techniques? I mean, there's been studies that say that if you talk to your child in complete sentences, even when your child can't talk back, that child will later have better communication skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, interestingly, they looked at parent-school interactions, not parent-child interactions. Mm-hmm. So how often does the parent visit the school, or has the teacher heard from the parent? Or so it seemed like sort of how involved they were, not exactly what they were doing in that involvement. So anyway,
I always try to talk to my children in 5-paragraph essays, and I think that's going to help them in fourth or fifth grade.
Right.
So another big thing to Mark. First of all, thank you. That was very interesting and important. And thank you, Dan Willingham, for flagging that. Okay, Amber.
What?
your last podcast until the big day.
Dude, that's right. Who's going to be filling in? We got to figure that out. Dara's going to do two jobs here?
She might have two jobs. She's going to have to do your research minute.
Woo-hoo.
Yes. And so you're getting married.
Getting married.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And it's just stressful. And everybody who's ever been married says the same thing. It's stressful. And then it's over in a flash.
Yeah. And then it's happy. It's happy.
Forgot about it. And then it's happy.
Yes.
Right. But it's not very happy right now, people. It's just very, very stressful. So
very nice. So don't email Amber that annoying question about her wedding that you were thinking about sending.
That's right. But you know, honestly, I've had so many people email me and tell me congratulations because they heard I was getting married on the podcast.
Yep.
Yeah. Matter of fact, Dan Goldhaber just emailed me a couple days ago and said, Amber, congratulations. Just heard the good news.
It's a family, Amber. Family. We have a family here that listens to the show. So cool. Love it. Love it. All right. Well, till next week.
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.